You're listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Hi, everybody, and welcome to We Are STS. I'm your host, Professor Joe Kane. This is another bonus episode. Today we have the second in our series from the STS newsroom. Remember, that was a summer traineeship program in science journalism. Students in the STS newsroom worked for 8 weeks on all sorts of journalism projects, including writing for our magazine STS Alchemy and producing some podcasts. They produce some really impressive stuff. Today, it's the turn of Odile Lainen. Odile completed her undergraduate degree in 2021. She did a clever thing when creating her podcast. Odile picked up something that frustrated her throughout her whole degree. Indeed, it frustrates all of us in the department from time to time. We always get asked, what is STS? The answers we give sometimes get quite complicated. There just isn't a clear and simple box for fitting in all the fabulous stuff we do. Odile set off to answer that question, what is STS, by asking a few of her tutors to talk about a few of her favorite topics. I think she strikes gold here, because what she really is telling us is the answer to the question, what good is STS? Her episode is self-contained. That means I get to sit back and listen along with you. I'll see you on the other side.
What do you study?
Science and technology studies.
What do you do with that?
What do you do with that?
That sounds interesting.
So you do science?
What do you do?
Science and what?
What do I study? Of course, I study science and society at University College London. Over the past 3 years, I have refined and memorized my go-to two-sentence explanation. It goes something like this. I'm not the one in the lab doing the science, but I study science and technology from a social science and humanities perspective. I do things like history of science, science policy, science communication, and so on. Whilst this gets people off my back, I feel like it doesn't give them a sense of what we really do in STS, how we think about science and technology, the kinds of questions we ask, and how STS is everywhere, from fruit flies to Facebook, cars, clocks, and train schedules. That's why today I want to take a different approach. In this podcast, I speak to three of my teachers about three ordinary things that triggered light bulb moments in my own journey of discovering STS. Let's begin with the fruit fly. The fruit fly, also known as Drosophila, was involved in one of the major shifts in biology that happened in the early 20th century. Yes, I'm talking about the tiny annoying flies that populate our kitchens when we've left the food out for too long. Or am I? I spoke to one of my former teachers about this intriguing organism. It's so nice to have you, Becky. To start off, would you like to just quickly introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Becky Martin. I recently completed my PhD in the Science and Technology Studies department. And my work focuses on the history of anatomy and biology in the late 19th century, early 20th century, which is the same period as the fly group.
Becky took us off and jumped straight into it. The fly group. This was a group of scientific researchers created by Thomas Hunt Morgan at Columbia University around 1910. They collaborated on experiments using the fly and achieved some significant advances in the field of genetics. I asked Becky, what was the big shift in genetics that can be traced back to the fly group?
So this, at the same time as the Fly Group in the 1910s, early 20th century, we also have the rise of Mendelian genetics. So Mendelian genetics is actually a lot older than this point, but it has a resurgence in the early 20th century, and it becomes a lot more popular. And this is the sort of genetics that people might have studied at school in kind of year 9 GCSE biology, where it's talking about recessive genes, and that you know, brown eyes are a dominant eye colour and blue eyes are a recessive eye colour, and you have to have two parents with the genes for blue eyes to get blue eyes. And that is what's happening in genetics at this point. So obviously, if you can control what you have in your genetic population, like you do with the standard fruit fly, it means that you can control what's going to be coming afterwards in when they reproduce and produce more fruit flies. So it's part of understanding the mechanisms of inheritance and how that passes from generation to generation, and therefore being able to standardize through breeding, basically.
So the fruit fly basically is a research tool in the sense that it's a standard organism, right? So what is this? What is a standard organism, and how did that revolutionize scientific work at the time?
So a standard organism, or standardized organism, is something which has been genetically bred to be identical, which means for scientific research that you've controlled for a lot of different factors if you're then going to use this in your experiments. And that's obviously important for scientific method, which is something we study in STS, because we're trying to make replicatable results.
Mm-hmm. So a question we ask a lot in STS, I think, is how is science made, right? That's one of our key concerns. And so how is the case of the fruit fly an interesting example of how we can approach this question, or giving insights on this question?
Yeah, so as you say, how is science made is something that we really think about from all perspectives in STS, so from sociology, history and philosophy. And obviously, thinking about this as a historian, this shows us kind of the advent of standardization. The standardized fruit flies is just one element in this story.
In STS, obviously, that's not the only example, right? We talk about standards and how they came about in many, many different and interesting ways. And I think also your own work speaks to that as well, right?
Yeah, so my work is on anatomical models, so the three-dimensional models that you can kind of take pieces out of, which lots of people will have encountered at school, and they're still around today. And essentially, I look at the time at which they are standardized, which is just before the fly group here. So my work is on the 1870s to the 1910s, and it's looking at how the human body is generalized and standardized in a similar way, but as an object, as an object rather than through kind of genetic mutations, and the impact that you know has on the knowledge that can be created around those objects. So the idea that the body can be generalized means that we're seeing, okay, so this is the human body. It thinks about how we term what is a normal condition and what is the normal state of being, as opposed to the abnormal. And that's got some significant kind of long-standing ramifications for medical education today. And there's a lot of campaigns at the moment about decolonizing and diversifying the medical curriculum. And for me, the roots of those problems essentially are in the end of the 19th century, when we start to standardize how we think about the body in medicine. And that obviously being created in the end of the 19th century, there are a lot of social biases attached, and in a white, male, youthful and physically fit kind of way. So there's a creation of a standard there, which I think a lot of people recognise as persevering into the modern period. And obviously the Drosophila is exactly the same. It's still that, you know, it's still a useful scientific tool for genetic research. And so there's a lot of things which we think of as this is, you know, this is over 100 years ago, which actually are still influencing at least how we conceptualize science and conceptualize the importance of standards and the importance of homogeneous groups and thinking about mutations. And that's all part of the current milieu that we're in today in scientific research.
I think it's really interesting kind of looking at how, on the one hand, obviously we can see how standards are a really useful tool in the production of knowledge and maybe even essential, I don't know. but then obviously on the other hand, there's quite significant dangers as we've seen that kind of come with that. And especially if we don't study the kind of these standards and how they came about and acknowledge that that they're not predetermined as such, if that makes sense, I think.
Yeah, exactly. So standards, I don't think that standards are unuseful. So I think what the fly shows us is that standardizing things can be very useful for knowledge production. It's just what we dictate to be the standard, which can be dangerous. And that's where we can see the social and cultural influences on creating a standardized object. And because anything could have been made to be the standard fruit fly, right? There could have any one mutation they could have chosen. Obviously they're going to choose one which is fairly prevalent, but they could have chosen any one to select for. And there's the same idea is that, you know, there are definitely standards are useful for things like medical research, but thinking about what is normal for different groups is also really helpful. So one of the reasons that women are often excluded from medical trials, and Dr. Alison McGregor's book Sex Matters kind of digs into this, as does Angela Saini's book Inferior. And essentially the idea that women are not included in medical trials because we have such fluctuating hormones and that will throw off the whole trial, despite the fact that hormone fluctuations are a normal part of womanhood. And so that is a standard for women. And that's something that isn't considered to be the useful standard. So there is a lot of discussion around that today about what is the standard that we're choosing and where does that come from and what cultural significance does that standard have? So I definitely think there's a lot to discuss, and STS is very heavily embroiled in those discussions, obviously.
Standards are a great example of how science and culture are intertwined in the making of science. In my next conversation, I asked questions about a further standard, one that is so ingrained into our lives that I personally have taken it for granted until very recently. It allows us to ask questions about how science and technology exist outside of the lab, shaping and being shaped by the society we live in. This conversation with one of my professors is about standard time.
My name is John Agar. I am a professor at the Department of Science and Technology Studies. I'm also co-head of department there. But I am a historian of modern science and technology. What's standard time? Well, I'm in London at the moment, and the time on my clock will be the same time as the clock that you look at in other parts of of England. So the time is the same across all of England, and at the moment it's British summertime, and that's a standard time. But that's a creation. That's a modern creation. There's time of day is measured, if you think about it, well, by the movement of the sun, right? So, you know, when is the sun highest above the horizon? That would be noon. But if you're further east, that happens earlier. So in fact, time when you're on the east coast is different than time when you're on the west coast. But that would mean time varies all the way across the country. So in the 19th century, we changed that, and we decided that we would have the same time across the entirety of the country, and that is standard time.
Before my STS degree, I never thought about today's coordination of time as an achievement that could be studied. I asked John Ager, why is it so interesting to look at standard time?
We do take standard time for granted. And actually, I think some of the things we take for granted are often the most interesting things. You know, they might seem really boring or mundane. We don't even notice them as we go around the day. But actually, they're really important. Standard time allows us to coordinate our lives. I can say to you that we're going to have this Zoom call at a certain time, and we know what that means. And we couldn't do that if we didn't have an agreed standard time. And of course, that makes us fantastically productive as an economy and as a society. So it underpins really the immense wealth of the modern world. But you can go through a day without even reflecting on that at all. And I think that's one of the interesting things about our subject, science and technology studies, is it pays attention to some of those infrastructures that surround us that are really important and which decisions and values are built into that shape how we live and how we work. But unless we stop and notice them, then we can't wonder whether we could organise it better, perhaps.
We see how standard time changed the world and shapes the society we live in today. But let's rewind a little. How did it come about in the first place?
So it's a story of the 19th century, and it's a story of the growth of the railways. So the railway systems, which start in roughly the 1820s, 1830s, when you get the very first steam engines placed on tracks that connect towns and cities, and it really takes off in the 1840s. So the problem was, you go to Reading, west of London, that was 4 minutes behind London time. And what we began to see then is immense risks and dangers, because railways are fast, a lot of energy there, and they're carrying goods and people at high speed around on the tracks, and of course that can lead to railway accidents. Railway accidents were often caused because of uncertainties about time. So what time did that train set off? Well, if you're a few minutes out, then you could be in collision with another train. And almost coincidentally, alongside the railway, a second technology came into being, and that's the telegraph. And the telegraph is an electrical system of communication. You can communicate faster than ever before. Before, you could only communicate really as fast as a horse could run. It meant that you could signal ahead and tell another town miles away that a train was coming. But you could also say, this is what the time is here. And you could coordinate and make sure that the time in, let us say, Manchester was the same as the time in London.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty interesting. So when thinking about the kind of introduction of a new technology, like in this case, standard time, as you've mentioned, there's the one side to it, which is like the technological possibility, I guess. So like in terms of like the telegraph, for example, that you needed in order to have consistent time. Then you mentioned that there's the demand for it, in a sense, I guess you could say, as in we have this other new technology, the railway system, where we need a consistency of time in order for it to run safely. But then also there's a lot more that goes into the establishment of a technology, right? And its acceptance in society as well.
Yes, that's right. I mean, and it's unintended consequences. I mean, when the first railways were being planned in the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s, I think people weren't thinking, oh, this is going to transform how we think of time and how we organize our lives. It shows that technological systems can sometimes have consequences that aren't predicted as well. But you can understand where they come from by looking closely at the system. There's deep values attached to these infrastructures too. I mean, if we didn't live in a world where I think it really mattered when goods were delivered on time or when people stop and start work, i.e. living in an industrial capitalist economy, then we probably wouldn't have our standard time that we think of as natural. Actually, it's deeply artificial. It's a product of our particular kind of society that we live in.
Another aspect that always plays a role, I feel like, with technology is the whole politics aspect, right? So if we think about standard time, and it made me smile when I read that when there was a discussion of like how to introduce the standard time, and the French originally objected the whole Greenwich time because it was British time. So
there was a big argument there, because after all, it is arbitrary. You know, there's no privileged place. There's no reason why it should be based on the Greenwich Meridian. That is just simply an agreement. It needed an international meeting and a lot of argument. And there were rival claims. Why not have Paris? After all, Paris is the home of the meter. And the standardisation of length, why not have it as the place of the standardisation of time as well? So it was entirely up for grabs. But it does reflect, you know, international politics at the end of the 19th century.
And on that note, I guess you begin to see this whole, like, how technology and science and culture are just so interlinked, right? So not just in the sense of like why standard time came about in that way, but also if you look at like responses to it, for example, so how people responded to standard time, for example, in art, in culture,
and in science. The scientist that everyone has heard of, Albert Einstein, and some of his extraordinary ideas that he discovered in physics around the turn of the 19th into the 20th century. So his famous special relativity papers from 1905. These are some of the greatest intellectual moments of modern history. He was thinking about how do you coordinate time? How do you know, or can you know, that time in one place the same as time in another? That's the kind of questions he was asking. And he was asking those questions because at that time he was a patent clerk, famously in the Swiss city of Bern, and he was looking at patents about the coordination of time, including railway time, including time between cities and industrial coordination, using telegraph lines to standardize time. This is the world that Einstein was living in, and the questions that he was asking, absolutely deeper than anyone else at the time, and discovered these incredible revolutionary ideas in physics as a result. But he was in the right place to do that, and the right place to do that was in a world, Europe, over 100 years ago, where standardized, coordinated time was incredibly important.
With standard time, we started off speaking about how the organization of our society changed fundamentally in the 19th century. We spoke about new technologies, political tensions, and ultimately, this discussion led us back to a specific scientific research like Albert Einstein's revolutionary theory of relativity. These connections are why, in STS, we study science and technology in context. our next and final Ordinary Thing will highlight how STS speaks to current political debates and how it can help us create the future world we want to live in. I spoke to Dr. Jack Stilgo about the car.
I'm Jack Stilgo. I'm an associate professor in science and technology studies at UCL, and I work on things to do with emerging technologies. So anything where, you know, there might be a technology that is attracting a lot of attention, maybe attracting a lot of investment, and it may not be clear what the issues are, you know, who benefits, who wins, who loses from those technologies. I'm interested in whether we can study those things, technologies in the making, if you like.
Perfect. So you've already mentioned one of the key questions that we ask is of technologies is who benefits, who loses out, right? So in the case of the motor car, how could we apply that question to this case study?
So the motor car is a great example of a technology that now, you know, is sort of woven into the fabric of everyday life. You know, almost all societies around the world are in some way dependent upon the car. And we know from, you know, more than a century of aggregated knowledge something about who benefits, what the car allows us to do as people, and what the harms and injustices are that are enabled through the motor car. The question that, you know, I think that leads to is, well, what could we have done differently when the motor car, right, an old technology, was a new technology? Could we have anticipated the world of the future? It's a really hard problem, but I think it's the sort of problem that we need to grapple with if we're to make good decisions about technologies.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you, that's a really interesting one about, like, talking of uncertainties as well, right? If you say we have to think, could we have anticipated, could we have known how this technology would have eventually turned out? A quote that I really like, I think it's from one of your papers, that I think really speaks to this is, and gives a feel for kind of the expectations that people had for the car to replace the horse cart, I think. So this quote goes, streets will be cleaner, jams and blockades less likely to occur, and accidents less frequent, for the horse is not so manageable as a mechanical vehicle.
Right. And so that's sort of typical of the promises that are made about a new technology. That quote was actually from the end of the 19th century, right? So this is when, I mean, the motor car was recognizable as the object that we know today, right? But it sort of looked a bit like a, you know, two bicycles shoved together with an engine on top rather than a contemporary motor car. But there in that quote, you see all of the hype, right? And none of the appreciation of the possible downsides, and also none of the appreciation of everything else that it takes to make a technology work. So when we think about an object like a car, a science and technology studies approach would be to say, don't just look at the object, right? Look at all of the things around that object that are required in order for it to function. Look at the roads, look at the fuel, look at the laws, look at the amount of policing it requires to enforce those laws. Look at the way that we as humans have to behave differently in and around that object in order to realize those benefits that always get hyped up at the early stage.
I think that's also a really important debate right now with the emerging self-driving car, right? To think about it, like, I feel like it's quite common today to think of it as in the software that is needed, the self-driving future that is hyped up as being so close, and all we need is, it's kind of constructed as a technological problem, as in once we develop the software, it'll all be fine. But from what I understand, obviously, it's a lot more complex than that.
Absolutely. So, you know, the excitement about a self-driving car is that, right, this thing that seemed a few years ago to be completely impossible, which, you know, a computer driving a car would have seemed absolutely absurd 20 years ago. But, you know, now with advances in artificial intelligence, the technology is now talked about as though it's inevitable. And one of the things that I'm interested in asking people about, in thinking about, is what else it would take to make self-driving cars an actual realistic possibility, not just for a few people in Phoenix, Arizona, right, who see these things shuttling around outside their houses, but to actually make a difference in the same way that the car has made a difference. And there it's about far more than just getting the AI to work, right? The world will need to adjust. The world will need to adapt to the technology just as the technology adapts to the world. But the story that we're currently hearing, you know, if you were to listen to Elon Musk, doesn't contain any of those sorts of complexities.
The hype that often exists around emerging technologies consists of promises about how they will change our world for the better. These promises may quickly turn into demands on the world to change, to accommodate for the technology.
So if you take that quote that you mentioned about the transition from the horse to the car, right, that's the promise. It says the car is going to change the world. And it did change the world, but also it made huge demands on the world, right? So if you were to look at a place like, I don't know, I mean, Phoenix, Arizona is a great example, where they're currently testing a lot of self-driving cars. That is an entirely car-dependent place. In order for the benefits of the car to be realized, the place itself has to be designed around the car. It is now almost impossible to live in Phoenix, Arizona, if you don't have access to that technology, right? And all of the other bits of the technological system that are required. So if you're, you know, a cycling campaigner, or you're trying to put a public transport system into Phoenix, Arizona, it's really hard because, you know, another thing that STS people would point to is the way that technologies get locked into our lives. It becomes really hard to change once we become dependent on technologies.
Yeah, definitely. No, the thinking about the system of roads, for example, that kind of underpins the car that we use today, I think is really interesting, especially thinking of, again, who wins, who loses in terms of different groups. So, for example, say pedestrians versus drivers. I think that's also a really interesting way to look at it, especially looking at like instances where that's actually being challenged right now.
Yeah, absolutely. So this it's a really, I think it's interesting being in London as well, because in some ways London, you know, predates the technology, and so the car's domination of the city has always been an incomplete one in London. But also being in London during a pandemic that has represented, I mean, among other things, an unprecedented experiment in changing mobility patterns, right? There was a time a year ago, so spring 2020, when the amount of moving around just completely collapsed in London. And actually some policymakers saw this as an opportunity to run their own experiments in what have become known as low traffic neighborhoods, right? Which is quite an interesting pushback against the car, taking advantage of the fact that there were very few cars on the roads. And now we're seeing, you know, as people get back to driving, we're seeing the politics of that explode back into life.
Yeah, and I mean, initiatives like London Car Free Day, for example, right, attempts to imagine how our future, our technological future in transport respect could look differently, right? I think that's also really important. In general, an interesting question, how do the ways that we imagine technologies, how can they actually have a concrete impact on the present and the future?
I think that's a lovely way of talking about it. Yeah, absolutely. Because imagination is something that, when it comes to technology, most of the time, you know, is sort of privatized, and we allow people like Elon Musk, but maybe also, you know, sci-fi authors, you know, to have a sort of oligopoly of imagination and working out how to bring members of the public into that project to collectively imagine technological futures is a really interesting way of thinking about it.
Definitely. So then taking that into account, I guess in an ideal world, we would have these kinds of discussions before the technology is embedded into our society, before there is this lock-in that we talked about and we can't go back anymore. However, obviously, looking at that quote, for example, that had, very different predictions or imaginings of how this technology would change the world, I think that raises the question of, is there a way that people could even have known the dramatic consequences of, for example, say, combustion engines with their CO2 emissions that are polluting the planet, congestion being a huge issue, still road accidents as a major cause of death. Is there a way that could this have been predicted before if we had only tried? Or to some, because I feel like to some extent, maybe these uncertainties, we just have to find ways of dealing with them somehow.
One of the ways that we might engage with the uncertainties that come from any new technology, right? Could we have imagined a car-dependent society in say, 1900? Is to think not just about what a single technology might do. Does it solve a problem? Is it good? Is it bad? Is it dangerous? Or anything else, right? Those sort of direct questions. But to think about what technologies might mean at scale. And I think this is something we're really bad at. So, you know, a few cars on the road isn't a problem. You put thousands of cars together and they become a classic collective action problem, the problem of traffic. And as soon as you then have to design your world around this becoming the dominant form of transport, you create other problems. Now, to an extent, sort of innovation is a constant social experiment involving the realization and mitigation of those issues. You know, you're sort of, to use an analogy, you're trying to fix the bike while riding it, right? And it's problematic, and maybe there's an aspect of that is sort of predestined. But also, we do need to have a look at technologies when they are new, when they are small, and imagine what they might look like when they're big. So, you know, I mean, take something like Facebook, right? Facebook's a really nice example of a technology where you think, well, you know, surely a few people being able to contact each other, that seems like a good thing, right? It, Facebook's mission was to connect people. And you think, yeah, fair enough. When Facebook has 2 or 3 billion users, right, it suddenly becomes a very different socio-technical entity. And then, you know, we're faced with really difficult choices about how you hold to account this company that has in some ways become more powerful than many governments.
So, what do I study? My revised answer is this. I study connections. Connections between science and art, the laboratory and society, facts and values, politics and innovation, the past and the present. I think that recognizing these has helped me understand the complex world we live in a little better. Thank you for listening. And thank you to Becky Martin, John Agar, and Jack Stilgo for the inspiring conversations. I will leave the last word to Professor John Agar, answering the question, why STS?
So science and technology are just so important for shaping the modern world, but they don't do so alone. What really matters how science and technology fits into the wider world, fits into different ways of living, different wishes, different desires for what kind of future we want. And there's bound to be conflicts about that as well. And that's what politics is. So science and technology are really important, but you need to understand how they fit in a society, what their politics are, in terms of how you resolve conflicts, for example, how it's communicated. And that's what our subject is. It's a subject that looks at that whole. It looks at how you make decisions about what kind of world that depends on science and technology is going to be. What kind of world is it? And what kind of world do we want? And that's why science and technology studies, STS, is the best subject in the world.
The music in this podcast was Particles and Sugar Fairies by Raphael Crux, Sneaky Snitch and Garden Music by Kevin McLeod.
It is available on the website filmmusic.io.
Well, that's our show for today. Well done, Odile. That was a great job. You can read more about Odile and sample some of her other journalism in this year's edition of STS Alchemy. That's the department's annual magazine. Links are in the show notes. Odile's podcast is one of five we're releasing over the winter break. Just keep your ears open for more. If you're a UCL student and you want to be part of the STS newsroom, watch out for our news about the program for summer 2022. We'll have information in circulation sometime in the middle of term two. If you're an STS student and you just can't wait, think about volunteering a bit of your time to help out on the podcast. We have some ideas on how you can do that. Have a look at information on our website, then get in touch. There's lots of options available. We Are STS is a production of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. If you're wondering about our degrees in teaching, just drop us a line. We're always happy to talk. And yes, that includes asking us about our two undergraduate degree programs. They're unique, highly regarded by our peers, and filled to the brim with experience and ambition. Lots of reasons for you to want to join us. Music today included a bunch of pieces. Intro and outro music was Rollin' at Five by Kevin MacLeod. Music inside the episode is listed in the show notes. All of it came from the fabulous website, filmmusic.io. Finally, you can find out more about the show, tell us what you think, and listen to past episodes just by visiting our website. Here's the address, so write it down. It's ucl.ac.uk/sts/podcast. That's it for today, everybody. Thanks again to Odile. Thanks also to you for coming along. Till next time, I'm Professor Joe Kane, and remember that together, we are STS. Bye now. You've been listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Subscribe to the show and join us online. The address, ucl.ac.uk/sts/podcast.